in what used to be his favorite place, drinking his beer slowly, like he used to, reading stories in the lights. The old central neighborhoods are packed in tight, below an eternal organic haze. In other cities, you breathe industrial contaminants, but in L.A., you breathe amino acids. The hazy sprawl is ringed and netted with glowing lines like hot wires in a toaster. At the outlet of the canyon, it comes close enough that the light sharpens and breaks up into stars, arches, glowing letters. Streams of red and white corpuscles throb down highways to the fuzzy logic of intelligent traffic lights. Farther away, spreading across the basin, a million sprightly logos smear into solid arcs, like geometric points merging into curves. To either side of the franchise ghettos, the low-glow dwindles across a few shallow layers of development and into a surrounding dimness that is burst here and there by the blaze of a security spotlight in someone's backyard. The franchise and the virus work on the same principle. What thrives in one place will thrive in another. You just have to find a sufficiently virulent business plan, condense it into a three-ring binder, its DNA, Xerox it, and embed it in the fertile lining of a well-traveled highway, preferably one with a left turn lane. Then the growth will expand until it runs up against its property lines. In olden times, you'd wander down to Mom's Cafe for a bite to eat and a cup of joe, and you would feel right at home. It worked just fine if you never left your hometown. But if you went to the next town over, everyone would look up and stare at you when you came in the door, and the blue plate special would be something you didn't recognize. If you did enough traveling, you'd never feel at home anywhere. But when a businessman from New Jersey goes to Dubuque, he knows he can walk into a McDonald's and no one will stare at him. He can order without having to look at the menu, and the food will always taste the same. McDonald's is home, condensed into a three-ring binder and Xeroxed. No surprises is the motto of the franchise ghetto. Its good housekeeping seal, subliminally blazoned on every sign and logo that make up the curves and grids of light that outline the basin. The people of America, who live in the world's most surprising and terrible country, take comfort in that motto. Follow the low-glow outward, to where the growth is enfolded into the valleys and the canyons, and you find the land of the refugees. They have fled from the true America, the America of atomic bombs, scalpings, hip-hop, chaos theory, cement overshoes, snake handlers, spree killers, spacewalks, buffalo jumps, drive-bys, cruise missiles, Sherman's March, gridlock, motorcycle gangs, and bungee jumping. They have parallel parked their bimbo boxes in identical computer-designed burbclave street patterns and secreted themselves in symmetrical sheetrock shitholes with vinyl floors and ill-fitting woodwork and no sidewalks, vast house farms out in the low-glow wilderness, a culture medium for a medium culture. The only ones left in the city are street people feeding off debris. Immigrants thrown out like shrapnel from the destruction of the Asian powers, young bohos, and the techno-media priesthood of Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. Young, smart people like David and Hero who take the risk of living in the city because they like stimulation and they know they can handle it. YT can't really tell where they are. It's clear that they're stuck in traffic. It's not like this is predictable or anything. YT must get underway now, she announces. No reaction for a sec. Then the hacker guy sits back in his chair, stares out through his goggles, ignoring the 3D compu display, taking in a nice view of the wall. Okay, he says. Quick as a mongoose, the man with the glass eye darts in, yanks the aluminum case out of the cryogenic cylinder, tosses it to YT. Meantime, one of the lounging around mafia guys is opening the back door of the truck, giving them all a nice view of a traffic jam on the boulevard. One other thing, the man with the glass eye says, and shoves an envelope into one of YT's multitudinous pockets. What's that? YT says. He holds up his hand self-protectively.
Don't worry,
It's just a little something. Now get going. He motions at the guy who's holding her plank. The guy turns out to be fairly hip, because he just throws the plank. It lands at an odd angle on the floor between them. But the spokes have long ago seen the floor coming, calculated all the angles, extended and flexed themselves like the legs and feet of a basketball player coming back to earth from a monster dunk. The plank lands on its feet, banks this way, then that, as it regains its balance, then steers itself right up to YT and stops beside her. She stands on it, kicks a few times, flies out the back door of the semi and onto the hood of a Pontiac that was following them much too closely. Its windshield makes a nice surface to bank off of, and she gets her direction neatly reversed by the time she hits the pavement. The owner of the Pontiac is honking self-righteously, but there's no way he can chase her down because traffic is totally stopped. YT is the only thing for miles around that is actually capable of movement, which is the whole point of couriers in the first place. The Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates number 1106 is a pretty big one. Its low serial number implies great age. It was built long ago, when land was cheap and lots were big. The parking lot is half full. Usually all you see at Reverend Wayne's are old beaters with wacky Spanish expressions nail-polished on the rear bumpers. The rides of Central American evangelicals who have come up north to get decent jobs and escape the relentlessly Catholic style of their homelands. This lot also has a lot of just plain old regular bimbo boxes with license plates from all the burbclaves. Traffic is moving a little better on this stretch of the boulevard, and so YT comes into the lot at a pretty good clip, takes one or two orbits around the franchise to work off her speed. A smooth parking lot is hard to resist when you are going fast, and to look at it from a slightly less juvenile point of view, it's a good idea to scope things out, to be familiar with your environment. YT learns that this parking lot is linked with that of a chop shop franchise next door.
We turn any vehicle into cash in minutes.
Which in turn flows into the lot of a neighboring strip mall. A dedicated thrasher could probably navigate from L.A. to New York by coasting from one parking lot into the next. This parking lot makes popping and skittering noises in some areas. Looking down, she sees that behind the franchise, near the dumpster, the asphalt is strewn with small glass vials, like the one that Squeaky was looking at last night. They are scattered about like cigarette butts behind a bar. When the footpads of her wheels pass over these vials, they tiddlywink out from underneath and skitter across the pavement. People are lined up out the door, waiting to get in. YT jumps the line and goes inside. The front room of the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates is, of course, like all the others. A row of padded vinyl chairs where worshippers can wait for their number to be called, with a potted plant at each end and a table strewn with primeval magazines. A toy corner where kids can kill time, reenacting imaginary cosmic battles in injection-molded plastic. A counter done up in fake wood, so it looks like something from an old church. Behind the counter, a pudgy high school babe, dishwater blonde hair that has been worked over pretty good with a curling iron, blue metal flake eyeshadow, an even coat of red makeup covering her broad gelatinous cheeks, a flimsy sort of choir robe thrown over her t-shirt. When YT comes in, she is right in the middle of a transaction. She sees YT right away, but no three-ring binder anywhere in the world allows you to flag or fail in the middle of a transaction. Stymied, YT sighs and crosses her arms to convey impatience. In any other business establishment, she'd already be raising hell and marching around behind the counter as if she owned the place. But this is a church, damn it. There's a little rack along the front of the counter bearing religious tracts, free for the taking, donation requested. Several slots in the rack are occupied by the Reverend Wayne's famous bestseller, How America Was Saved from Communism. Elvis Shot JFK. She pulls out the envelope that the man with the glass eye stuck into her pocket. It is not thick and soft enough to contain a lot of cash, unfortunately. It contains half a dozen snapshots. All of them feature Uncle Enzo. He is on the broad, flat horseshoe driveway of a large house, larger than any house YT has ever seen with her own two eyes. He is standing on a skateboard, or falling off of a skateboard, or coasting slowly, arms splayed wildly out to the sides, chased by nervous security personnel. A piece of paper is wrapped around the pictures. It says,
YT, thanks for your help. As you can see from these pictures, I tried the train for this assignment, but it's going to take some practice. Your friend, Uncle Enzo.
YT wraps the pictures up just the way they were, puts them back in her pocket, stifles a smile, returns to business matters. The girl in the robe is still performing her transaction behind the counter. The transactee is a stocky, Spanish-speaking woman in an orange dress. The girl types some stuff into the computer. The customer snaps her Visa card down on the fake wood altar top. It sounds like a rifle shot. The girl pries the card up using her inch-long fingernails, a dicey and complicated operation that makes YT think of insects climbing out of their egg sacs. Then she performs the sacrament, swiping the card through its electromagnetic slot with a carefully modulated sweep of the arm, as though tearing back a veil, handing over the slip, mumbling that she needs a signature and daytime phone number. She might as well have been speaking Latin, but that's okay since this customer is familiar with the liturgy and signs and numbers it before the words are fully spoken. Then it just remains for the word from on high. But computers and communications are awfully good these days, and it usually doesn't take longer than a couple of seconds to perform a charge card verification. The little machine beeps out its approval code. Heavenly tunes sing out from tinny speakers, and a wide pair of pearlescent doors in the back of the room swing majestically open.
Thank you for your donation, the girl says, slurring the words together into a single syllable.
The customer stomps toward the double doors, drawn in by hypnotic organ strains. The interior of the chapel is weirdly colored, illuminated partly by fluorescent fixtures wedged into the ceiling and partly by large colored light boxes that simulate stained glass windows. The largest of these, shaped like a fattened Gothic arch, is bolted to the back wall above the altar and features a blazing trinity: Jesus, Elvis, and the Reverend Wayne. Jesus gets top billing. The worshiper is not half a dozen steps into the place before she thuds down on her knees in the middle of the aisle and begins to speak in tongues.
Aria, aria, arisa, venamiri, isa, isa, venamiri, ayas, aria.
The door swings shut again.
Just a sec, the girl says, looking at YT a little nervously.
She goes around the corner and stands in the middle of the toy area, inadvertently getting the hem of her robe caught up in a ninja raft warrior's battle module, and knocks on the door to the potty.
Busy,
says a man's voice from the other side of the door.
The courier's here, the girl says.
I'll be right out, the man says more quietly.
And he really is right out. YT does not perceive any waiting time, no zipping up of the fly or washing of the hands. He is wearing a black suit with a clerical collar, pulling a lightweight black robe on over that as he emerges into the toy area, crushing little action figures and fighter aircraft beneath his black shoes. His hair is black and well-greased, with individual strands of gray, and he wears wire-rimmed bifocals with a subtle brownish tint. He has very large pores. And by the time he gets close enough that YT can see all of these details, she can also smell him. She smells Old Spice, plus a strong whiff of vomit on his breath. But it's not boozy vomit.
Give me that, he says, and yanks the aluminum briefcase from her hand.
YT never lets people do that.
You have to sign for it, she says.
But she knows it's too late. If you don't get them to sign first, you're screwed. You have no power, no leverage. You're just a brat on a skateboard. Which is why YT never lets people yank deliveries out of her hand. But this guy is a minister, for God's sake. She just didn't reckon on it. He yanked it out of her hand, and now he runs with it back to his office.
I can sign for it, the girl says.
She looks scared. More than that, she looks sick.
It has to be him personally, YT says. Reverend Dale T. Thorpe.
Now she's done being shocked and starting to be pissed, so she just follows him right into his office.
You can't go in there, the girl says. But she says it dreamily, sadly, like this whole thing is already half forgotten. YT opens the door. The Reverend Dale T. Thorpe sits at his desk. The aluminum briefcase is open in front of him. It is filled with the same complicated bit of business that she saw the other night after the Raven thing. The Reverend Dale T. Thorpe seems to be leashed by the neck to this device. No, actually, he is wearing something on a string around his neck. He was keeping it under his clothes, the way YT keeps Uncle Enzo's dog tags. He has pulled it out now and shoved it into a slot inside the aluminum case. It appears to be a laminated ID card with a barcode on it. Now he pulls the card out and lets it dangle down his front. YT cannot tell whether he has noticed her. He is typing on the keyboard, punching away with two fingers, missing letters, doing it again. Then motors and servos inside the aluminum case whir and shudder. The Reverend Dale T. Thorpe has unsnapped one of the little vials from its place in the lid and inserted it into a socket next to the keyboard. It is slowly drawn down inside the machine. The vial pops back out again. The red plastic cap is emitting grainy red light. It has little LEDs built into it, and they are spelling out numbers, counting down seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The Reverend Dale T. Thorpe holds the vial up to his left nostril. When the LED counter gets down to zero, it hisses, like air coming out of a tire valve. At the same time, he inhales deeply, sucking it all into his lungs. Then he shoots the vial expertly into his wastebasket. Reverend? The girl says. YT spins around to see her drifting toward the office. Would you do mine now? Please? The Reverend Dale T. Thorpe does not answer. He has slumped back in his leather swivel chair and is staring at a neon-framed blow-up of Elvis in his army days, holding a rifle.
Amalagin Zabandam Ganunkari
26. When he wakes up, it's the middle of the day, and he is all dried out from the sun, and birds are circling overhead, trying to decide whether he's dead or alive. Hiro climbs down from the roof of the turret, and, throwing caution to the wind, drinks 3 glasses of L.A. tap water. He gets some bacon out of David's fridge and throws it in the microwave. Most of General Jim's people have left, and there is only a token guard of soldiers down on the road. Hiro locks all the doors that look out on the hillside because he can't stop thinking about Raven. Then he sits at the kitchen table and goggles in. The Black Sun is mostly full of Asians, including a lot of people from the Bombay film industry, glaring at each other, stroking their black mustaches, trying to figure out what kind of hyper-violent action film will play in Persepolis next year. It is nighttime there. Hiro is one of the few Americans in the joint. Along the back wall of the bar is a row of private rooms, ranging from little tete-a-tetes to big conference rooms, where a bunch of avatars can gather and have a meeting. Juanita is waiting for Hiro in one of the smaller ones. Her avatar just looks like Juanita. It is an honest representation, with no effort made to hide the early suggestions of crow's feet at the corners of her big black eyes. Her glossy hair is so well resolved that Hiro can see individual strands refracting the light into tiny rainbows.
I'm at David's house. Where are you? Hiro says.
In an airplane, so I may break up, Juanita says.
You on your way here?
To Oregon, actually.
Portland?
Astoria.
Why on earth would you go to Astoria, Oregon at a time like this?
Juanita takes a deep breath, lets it out shakily. If I told you, we'd get into an argument.
What's the latest word on David? Hiro says.
The same.
Any diagnosis?
Juanita sighs, looks tired. There won't be any diagnosis, she says. It's a software, not a hardware problem.
Huh?
They're rounding up the usual suspects. CAT scans, NMR scans, PET scans, EEGs. Everything's fine. There's nothing wrong with his brain, his hardware.
It just happens to be running the wrong program?
His software got poisoned. David had a snow crash last night inside his head.
Are you trying to say it's a psychological problem?
It kind of goes beyond those established categories, Juanita says, because it's a new phenomenon. A very old one, actually.
Does this thing just happen spontaneously or what?
You tell me, she says. You were there last night. Did anything happen after I left?
He had a snow crash hypercard that he got from Raven outside the Black Sun.
Shit, that bastard.
Who's the bastard? Raven or David?
David. I tried to warn him.
He used it. Hero goes on to explain the brandy with the magic scroll. Then later he had computer trouble and got bounced.
I heard about that part, she says. That's why I called the paramedics.
I don't see the connection between David's computer having a crash and you calling an ambulance.
The brandy scroll wasn't just showing random static. It was flashing up a large amount of digital information in binary form. That digital information was going straight into David's optic nerve, which is part of the brain, incidentally. If you stare into a person's pupil, you can see the terminal of the brain.
David's not a computer. He can't read binary code.
He's a hacker. He messes with binary code for a living. That ability is firmwired into the deep structures of his brain, so he's susceptible to that form of information. And so are you, homeboy.
What kind of information are we talking about?
Bad news. A metavirus, Juanita says. It's the atomic bomb of informational warfare. A virus that causes any system to infect itself with new viruses.
And that's what made David sick?
Yes.
Why didn't I get sick?
Too far away. Your eyes couldn't resolve the bitmap. It has to be right up in your face.
I'll think about that one, Hero says. But I have another question. Raven also distributes another drug in reality, called, among other things, Snow Crash. What is it?
It's not a drug, Juanita says. They make it look like a drug and feel like a drug so that people will want to take it. It's laced with cocaine and some other stuff.
If it's not a drug, what is it?
It's chemically processed blood serum taken from people who are infected with the metavirus, Juanita says. That is, it's just another way of spreading the infection.
Who's spreading it?
L. Bob Reif's private church. All of those people are infected.
Hero puts his head in his hands. He's not exactly thinking about this.
He's letting it ricochet around in his skull, waiting for it to come to rest.
Wait a minute, Juanita. Make up your mind. This snow crash thing, is it a virus, a drug, or a religion?
Juanita shrugs. What's the difference? That Juanita is talking this way does not make it any easier for Hero to get back on his feet in this conversation.
How can you say that? You're a religious person yourself.
Don't lump all religion together.
Sorry.
All people have religions. It's like we have religion receptors built into our brain cells or something, and we'll latch onto anything that'll fill that niche for us. Now, religion used to be essentially viral. A piece of information that replicated inside the human mind, jumping from one person to the next. That's the way it used to be, and, unfortunately, that's the way it's headed right now. But there have been several efforts to deliver us from the hands of primitive, irrational religion. The first was made by someone named Enki about 4,000 years ago. The second was made by Hebrew scholars in the 8th century B.C., driven out of their homeland by the invasion of Sargon II, but eventually it just devolved into empty legalism. Another attempt was made by Jesus. That one was hijacked by viral influences within 50 days of his death. The virus was suppressed by the Catholic Church, but we're in the middle of a big epidemic that started in Kansas in 1900 and has been gathering momentum ever since. Do you believe in God or not? Hero says. First things first. Definitely. Do you believe in Jesus? Yes, but not in the physical, bodily resurrection of Jesus. How can you be a Christian without believing in that? I would say, Juanita says, how can you be a Christian with it? Anyone who takes the trouble to study the Gospels can see that the bodily resurrection is a myth that was tacked onto the real story several years after the real histories were written. It's so National Enquirer-esque, don't you think? Beyond that, Juanita doesn't have much to say. She doesn't want to get into it now, she says. She doesn't want to prejudice Hero's thinking at this point. Does that imply that there's going to be some other point? Is this a continuing relationship? Hero says. Do you want to find the people who infected David? Yes. Hell, Juanita. Even if it weren't for the fact that he is my friend, I'd want to find them before they infect me. Look at the babble stack, Hero, and then visit me if I get back from Astoria. If you get back, what are you doing there? Research. She's been putting on a businesslike front through this whole talk, spitting out information, telling Hero the way it is. But she's tired and anxious, and Hero gets the idea that she's deeply afraid. Good luck, he says. He was all ready to do some flirting with her during this meeting, picking up where they left off last night. But something has changed in Juanita's mind between then and now. Flirting is the last thing on her mind. Juanita's going to do something dangerous in Oregon. She doesn't want Hero to know about it so that he won't worry. There's some good stuff in the babble stack about someone named Inanna, she says. Who's Inanna? A Sumerian goddess. I'm sort of in love with her. Anyway, you can't understand what I'm about to do until you understand Inanna. Well, good luck, Hero says. Say hi to Inanna for me. Thanks. When you get back, I want to spend some time with you. The feeling is mutual, she says. But we have to get out of this first. Oh, I didn't realize I was in something. Don't be a sap. We're all in it. Hero leaves, exiting into the black sun. There is one guy wandering around the hacker quadrant who really stands out. His avatar doesn't look so hot, and he's having trouble controlling it. He looks like a guy who's just goggled into the metaverse for the first time and doesn't know how to move around. He keeps bumping into tables, and when he wants to turn around, he spins around several times, not knowing how to stop himself. Hero walks toward him because his face seems a little familiar. When the guy finally stops moving, long enough for Hero to resolve him clearly, he recognizes the avatar. It's a Clint, most often seen in the company of a brandy. The Clint recognizes Hero, and his surprised face comes on for a second, is then replaced by his usual stern, stiff-lipped, craggy appearance. He holds up his hands together in front of him, and Hero sees that he is holding a scroll, just like Brandy's. Hero reaches for his katana, but the scroll is already up in his face, spreading open to reveal the blue glare of the bitmap inside. He sidesteps, gets over to one side of the Clint, raising the katana overhead, snaps the katana straight down, and cuts the Clint's arms off. As the scroll falls, it spreads open even wider. Hero doesn't dare look at it now. The Clint is turned around and is awkwardly trying to escape from the black sun, bouncing from table to table like a pinball. If Hero could kill the guy, cut his head off, then his avatar would stay in the black sun, be carried away by the graveyard demons. Hero could do some hacking and maybe figure out who he is, where he's coming in from. But a few dozen hackers are lounging around the bar, watching all of this, and if they come over and look at the scroll, they'll all end up like David. Hero squats down, looking away from the scroll, and pulls up one of the hidden trap doors that lead down into the tunnel system. He's the one who coded those tunnels into the Black Sun to begin with. He's the only person in the whole bar who can use them. He sweeps the scroll into the tunnel with one hand, then closes the door. Kira can see the Clint, way over near the exit, trying to get his avatar aimed out through the door. Kira runs after him. If the guy reaches the street, he's gone. He'll turn into a translucent ghost. With a 50-foot head start in a crowd of a million other translucent ghosts, there's just no way. As usual, there's a crowd of wannabes gathered on the street out front. Hiro can see the usual assortment, including a few black and white people. One of those black and whites is YT. She's loitering out there waiting for Hiro to come out.
YT, he shouts. Chase that guy with no arms.
Hiro gets out the door just a few seconds after the Clint does. Both the Clint and YT are already gone. He turns back into the black sun, pulls up a trap door, and drops down into the tunnel system, the realm of the graveyard demons. One of them has already picked up the scroll and is trudging in toward the center to throw it on the fire.
Hey, bud, Hiro says. Take a right turn at the next tunnel and leave that thing in my office, okay? But do me a favor and roll it up first.
He follows the graveyard demon down the tunnel under the street until they're under the neighborhood where Hiro and the other hackers have their houses. Hiro has the graveyard demon deposit the rolled-up scroll in his workshop, down in the basement, the room where Hiro does his hacking. Then Hiro continues upstairs to his office.
'27.
His voice phone is ringing. Hiro picks it up.
Pod, YT says. I was beginning to think you'd never come out of there.
Where are you? Hiro says.
In reality or the metaverse?
Both.
In the metaverse, I'm on a plus-bound monorail train just past by Port 35.
Already? It must be an express.
Good thinking. That Clint you cut the arms off of is two cars ahead of me. I don't think he knows I'm following him.
Where are you in reality?
Public terminal across the street from a Reverend Wayne's, she says.
Oh, yeah? How interesting.
Just made a delivery there.
What kind of delivery?
An aluminum suitcase.
He gets the whole story out of her, or what he thinks is the whole story. There's no real way to tell.
You're sure that the babbling that the people did in the park was the same as the babbling that the woman did at the Reverend Wayne's?
Sure, she says. I know a bunch of people who go there.
Or their parents go there and drag them along, you know? To the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates?
Yeah, and they all do that speaking in tongues, so I've heard it before.
I'll talk to you later, Pod, Hiro says. I've got some serious research to do.
Later.
The Babel Infocalypse card is resting in the middle of his desk. Hiro picks it up. The librarian comes in. Hiro is about to ask the librarian whether he knows that Lagos is dead. But it's a pointless question. The librarian knows it, but he doesn't. If he wanted to check the library, he could find out in a few moments. But he wouldn't really retain the information. He doesn't have an independent memory. The library is his memory, and he only uses small parts of it at once.
What can you tell me about speaking in tongues? Hiro says.
The technical term is glossolalia, the librarian says.
Technical term? Why bother to have a technical term for a religious ritual?
The librarian raises his eyebrows.
Oh, there's a great deal of technical literature on the subject. It is a neurological phenomenon that is merely exploited in religious rituals.
It's a Christian thing, right?
Pentecostal Christians think so, but they are deluding themselves. Pagan Greeks did it. Plato called it theomania. The Oriental cults of the Roman Empire did it. Hudson Bay Eskimos, Chukchi shamans, Laps, Yakuts, Semang pygmies, the North Borneo cults, the tree-speaking priests of Ghana, the Zulu Amandiki cult, and the Chinese religious sect of Shang Ti Hui, spirit mediums of Tonga and the Brazilian Umbanda cult. The Tungus tribesmen of Siberia say that when the shaman goes into his trance and raves incoherent syllables, he learns the entire language of nature.
The language of nature.
Yes, sir. The Sukuma people of Africa say that the language is Kinaturu, the tongue of the ancestors of all magicians who are thought to have descended from one particular tribe.
What causes it?
If mystical explanations are ruled out, then it seems that glossolalia comes from structures buried deep within the brain, common to all people.
What does it look like?
How do these people act? C.W. Shumway observed the Los Angeles revival of 1906 and noted six basic symptoms: complete loss of rational control, dominance of emotion that leads to hysteria, absence of thought or will, automatic functioning of the speech organs, amnesia, and occasional sporadic physical manifestations such as jerking or twitching. Eusebius observed similar phenomena around the year 300, saying that the false prophet begins by a deliberate suppression of conscious thought and ends in a delirium over which he has no control.
What's the Christian justification for this? Is there anything in the Bible that backs this up?
Pentecost.
You mentioned that word earlier. What is it?
From the Greek Pentecostos, meaning 50th. It refers to the 50th day after the crucifixion.
Juanita just told me that Christianity was hijacked by viral influences when it was only 50 days old. She must have been talking about this. What is it?
And they were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. And at this sound the multitude came together, and they were bewildered, because each one heard them speaking in his own language. And they were amazed and wondered, saying, Are not all these who are speaking Galileans? And how is it that we hear, each of us, in his own native language? Parthians and Medes and Elamites and residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya belonging to Cyrene, and visitors from Rome, both Jews and proselytes, Cretans and Arabians, we hear them telling in our own tongues the mighty works of God. And all were amazed and perplexed, saying to one another, What does this mean? Acts 2, verses 4 through 12.
Damned if I know, Hero says. Sounds like Babel in reverse.
Yes, sir. Many Pentecostal Christians believe that the gift of tongues was given to them so that they could spread their religion to other peoples without having to actually learn their language. The word for that is xenoglossy.
That's what Rife was claiming in that piece of videotape on top of the Enterprise. He said he could understand what those Bangladeshis were saying.
Yes, sir.
Does that really work?
In the 16th century, Saint Louis Beltrand allegedly used the gift of tongues to convert somewhere between 30,000 and 300,000 South American Indians to Christianity.
What did the Jews think of this Pentecost thing, Hero says? They were still running the country, right?
The Romans were running the country, the librarian says, but there were a number of Jewish religious authorities. At this time, there were three groups of Jews: the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes.
I remember the Pharisees from Jesus Christ Superstar. They were the ones with the deep voices who were always hassling Christ.
They were hassling him, the librarian says, because they were religiously very strict. They adhered to a strong legalistic version of the religion. To them, the law was everything. Clearly, Jesus was a threat to them because he was proposing, in effect, to do away with the law.
He wanted a contract renegotiation with God.
This sounds like an analogy which I am not very good at, but even if it is taken literally, it is true.
Who were the other two groups?
The Sadducees were materialists.
Meaning what? They drove BMWs?
No. Materialists in the philosophical sense. All philosophies are either monist or dualist, Monists believe that the material world is the only world, hence materialists. Dualists believe in a binary universe, that there is a spiritual world in addition to the material world.
Well, as a computer geek, I have to believe in the binary universe.
The librarian raises his eyebrows. How does that follow?
Sorry, it's a joke. A bad pun. See, computers use binary code to represent information, so I was joking that I have to believe in the binary universe, that I have to be a dualist.
How droll, the librarian says, not sounding very amused.
Your joke may not be without genuine merit, however.
How's that? I was just kidding, really.
Computers rely on the one and the zero to represent all things. This distinction between something and nothing, this pivotal separation between being and non-being, is quite fundamental and underlies many creation myths.
Hero feels his face getting slightly warm, feels himself getting annoyed. He suspects that the librarian may be pulling his leg, playing him for a fool. But he knows that the librarian, however convincingly rendered he may be, is just a piece of software and cannot actually do such things.
Even the word science comes from an Indo-European root meaning to cut or to separate. The same root led to the word shit, which of course means to separate living flesh from non-living waste. The same root gave us scythe and scissors and schism, which have obvious connections to the concept of separation.
How about sword?
From a root with several meanings. One of those meanings is to cut or pierce. One of them is post or rod, and the other is simply to speak.
Let's stay on track, Hero says.
Fine. I can return to this potential conversation fork at a later time, if you desire.
I don't want to get all forked up at this point.
Tell me about the third group, the Essenes.
They lived communally and believed that physical and spiritual cleanliness were intimately connected. They were constantly bathing themselves, lying naked under the sun, purging themselves with enemas, and going to extreme lengths to make sure that their food was pure and uncontaminated. They even had their own versions of the Gospels, in which Jesus healed possessed people not with miracles, but by driving parasites such as tapeworm out of their body. These parasites are considered to be synonymous with demons.
They sound kind of like hippies.
The connection has been made before, but it is faulty in many ways. The Essenes were strictly religious and would never have taken drugs.
So to them, there was no difference between infection with a parasite, like tapeworm, and demonic possession.
Correct. Interesting.
I wonder what they would have thought about computer viruses.
Speculation is not in my ambit.
Speaking of which, Lagos was babbling to me about viruses and infection and something called a Namshub. What does that mean?
Namshub is a word from Sumerian.
Sumerian?
Yes, sir. Used in Mesopotamia until roughly 2000 BC, the oldest of all written languages.
Oh, so all the other languages are descended from it.
For a moment, the librarian's eyes glance upward as if he's thinking about something. This is a visual cue to inform Hero that he's making a momentary raid on the library.
Actually, no, the librarian says. No languages whatsoever are descended from Sumerian. It is an agglutinative tongue, meaning that it is a collection of morphemes or syllables that are grouped into words. Very unusual.
You are saying, Hero says, remembering David in the hospital, that if I could hear someone speaking Sumerian, it would sound like a long stream of short syllables strung together?
Yes, sir.
Would it sound anything like glossolalia?
Judgment call. Ask someone real, the librarian says.
Does it sound like any modern tongue?
There is no provable genetic relationship between Sumerian and any tongue that came afterward.
That's odd. My Mesopotamian history is rusty, Hero says. What happened to the Sumerians? Genocide?
No, sir. They were conquered, but there's no evidence of genocide per se.
Everyone gets conquered sooner or later, Hero says. But their languages don't die out. Why did Sumerian disappear?
Since I'm just a piece of code, I would be on very thin ice to speculate, the librarian says.
Okay. Does anyone understand Sumerian?
Yes. At any given time, it appears that there are roughly 10 people in the world who can read it.
Where do they work?
One in Israel, one at the British Museum, one in Iraq, one at the University of Chicago, one at the University of Pennsylvania, and 5 at Rife Bible College in Houston, Texas.
Nice distribution. And have any of these people figured out what the word Namshub means in Sumerian?
Yes. A Namshub is a speech with magical force. The closest English equivalent would be incantation, but this has a number of incorrect connotations.
Did the Sumerians believe in magic?
The librarian shakes his head minutely. This is the kind of seemingly precise question that is in fact very profound, and that pieces of software, such as myself, are notoriously clumsy at. Allow me to quote from Kramer, Samuel Noah, and Mayer, John R. Myths of Enki, the Crafty God, New York, Oxford, Oxford University Press, 1989. Quote, "Religion, magic, and medicine are so completely intertwined in Mesopotamia that separating them is frustrating and perhaps futile work. Sumerian incantations demonstrate an intimate connection between the religious, the magical, and the aesthetic, so complete that any attempt to pull one away from the other will distort the whole." End quote. There is more material in here that might help explain the subject.
In where?
In the next room, the librarian says, gesturing at the wall. He walks over and slides the rice paper partition out of the way. A speech with magical force. Nowadays, people don't believe in these kinds of things. Except in the metaverse, that is, where magic is possible. The metaverse is a fictional structure made out of code, and code is just a form of speech, the form that computers understand. The metaverse in its entirety could be considered a single vast Namshub, enacting itself on L. Bob Reif's fiber optic network. The voice phone rings.
"Just a second," Hero says.
"Take your time," the librarian says, not adding the obvious reminder that he can wait for a million years if need be. "Me again," Whitey says. "I'm still on the train. Stumps got off at Express Port 127.
That's the antipode of downtown. I mean, it's as far away from downtown as you can get."
"It is?"
"Yeah. 127 is 2 to the 7th power minus 1.
"Spare me, I take your word for it." "It's definitely out in the middle of fucking nowhere," she says.
"You didn't get off and follow him?"
"Are you kidding? All the way out here? It's 10,000 miles from the nearest building, Hero."
She has a point. The metaverse was built with plenty of room to expand. Almost all of the development is within 2 or 3 express ports, 500 kilometers or so of downtown. Port 127 is 20,000 miles away. What is there?
A black cube exactly 20 miles in size.
Totally black?
Yeah.
How can you measure a black cube that big?
I'm riding along looking at the stars, okay? Suddenly, I can't see them anymore on the right side of the train. I start counting local ports. I count 16 of them. We get to Express Port 127, and Stumpy climbs off and goes toward the black thing. I count 16 more local ports, and then the stars come out. Then I take 32 kilometers and multiply it by 0.6, and I get 20 miles. You asshole.
That's good, Hero says. That's good intel.
Who do you think owns a black cube 20 miles across?
Just going on pure irrational bias, I'm guessing L. Bob Reif. Supposedly, he has a big hunk of real estate out in the middle of nowhere where he keeps all the guts of the metaverse. Some of us used to smash into it occasionally when we were out racing motorcycles.
Well, gotta go, Pod.
28. Hiro hangs up and walks into the new room. The librarian follows. It's about 50 feet on a side. The center of the space is occupied by three large artifacts, or rather, three-dimensional renderings of artifacts. In the center is a thick slab of baked clay, hanging in space, about the size of a coffee table and about a foot thick. Hiro suspects that it is a magnified rendering of a smaller object. The broad surfaces of the slab are entirely covered with angular writing that Hiro recognizes as cuneiform. Around the edges are rounded parallel depressions that appear to have been made by fingers as they shape the slab. To the right of the slab is a wooden pole with branches on top, sort of a stylized tree. To the left of the slab is an 8-foot-high obelisk, also covered with cuneiform, with a bas-relief figure chiseled into the top. The figure shows a seated man handing another man what looks like a stick and a hoop. The room is filled with a three-dimensional constellation of hypercards hanging weightlessly in the air. It looks like a high-speed photograph of a blizzard in progress. In some places, the hypercards are placed in precise geometric patterns, like atoms in a crystal. In other places, whole stacks of them are clumped together. Drifts of them have accumulated in the corners, as though Lagos tossed them away when he was finished. Hiro finds that his avatar can walk right through the hypercards without disturbing the arrangement. It is, in fact, the three-dimensional counterpart of a messy desktop, all the trash still remaining wherever Lagos left it. The cloud of hypercards extends to every corner of the 50-by-50-foot space and from floor level all the way up to about 8 feet, which is about as high as Lagos's avatar could reach. How many hypercards in here?
10,463, the librarian says.
I don't really have time to go through them, Hiro says. Can you give me some idea of what Lagos was working on here?
Well, I can read back the names of all the cards if you'd like. Lagos grouped them into four broad categories: biblical studies, Sumerian studies, neurolinguistic studies, and intel gathered on Elbab Reif.
Without going into that kind of detail, what did Lagos have on his mind? What was he getting at?
What do I look like, a psychologist? The librarian says. I can't answer those kinds of questions.
Let me try it again. How does this stuff connect, if at all, to the subject of viruses?
The connections are elaborate. Summarizing them would require both creativity and discretion. As a mechanical entity, I have neither.
How old is this stuff? Hiro says, gesturing to the three artifacts.
The clay envelope is Sumerian. It is from the 3rd millennium BC. It was dug up from the city of Eridu in southern Iraq. The black steel, or obelisk, is the Code of Hammurabi, which dates from about 1750 BC. The tree-like structure is a Yahwistic cult totem from Palestine. It is called an Asherah. It's from about 900 BC.
Did you call that slab an envelope?
Yes. It has a smaller clay slab wrapped up inside of it. This was how the Sumerians made tamper-proof documents.
All these things are in a museum somewhere, I take it.
The Asherah and the Code of Hammurabi are in museums. The clay envelope is in the personal collection of Elbab Reif.
Elbab Reif is obviously interested in this stuff.
Reif Bible College, which he founded, has the richest archaeology department in the world. They have been conducting a dig in Eridu, which was the cult center of a Sumerian god named Enki.
How are these things related to each other? The librarian raises his eyebrows.
I'm sorry?
Well, let's try process of elimination. Do you know why Lagos found Sumerian writings interesting as opposed to, say, Greek or Egyptian?
Egypt was a civilization of stone. They made their art and architecture of stone so it lasts forever. But you can't write on stone. So they invented papyrus and wrote on that. But papyrus is perishable. So even though their art and architecture have survived, their written records, their data, have largely disappeared.
What about all those hieroglyphic inscriptions?
Bumper stickers, Lagos called them. Corrupt political speech. They had an unfortunate tendency to write inscriptions praising their own military victories before the battles had actually taken place.
And Sumer is different?
Sumer was a civilization of clay. They made their buildings of it and wrote on it, too. Their statues were of gypsum, which dissolves in water. So the buildings and statues have since fallen apart under the elements. But the clay tablets were either baked or else buried in jars. So all the data of the Sumerians have survived. Egypt left a legacy of art and architecture. Sumer's legacy is its megabytes.
How many megabytes?
As many as archaeologists bother to dig up. The Sumerians wrote on everything. When they built a building, they would write in cuneiform on every brick. When the buildings fell down, these bricks would remain scattered across the desert. In the Quran, the angels who are sent to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah say, quote, "We are sent forth to a wicked nation, so that we may bring down on them a shower of clay stones marked by your Lord for the destruction of the sinful." End quote. Lagos found this interesting. This promiscuous dispersal of information written on a medium that lasts forever. He spoke of pollen blowing in the wind. I gather that this was some kind of analogy.
It was. Tell me, has the inscription on this clay envelope been translated?
Yes. It is a warning. It says, quote, "This envelope contains the Namshub of Enki." End quote.
I know what a Namshub is. What is the Namshub of Enki?
The librarian stares off into the distance and clears his throat dramatically.
"Once upon a time, there was no snake, there was no scorpion, there was no hyena, there was no lion, there was no wild dog, no wolf, there was no fear, no terror. Man had no rival. In those days, the land Shubar-Hamazi, Harmony-Tongue Sumer, the great land of the May of Princeship, Yuri, the land having all that is appropriate, the land Martu, resting in security, the whole universe, the people well cared for, to Enlil in one tongue gave speech. Then the Lord Defiant, the Prince Defiant, the King Defiant, Enki, the Lord of Abundance, whose commands are trustworthy, the Lord of Wisdom, who scans the land, the leader of the gods, the Lord of Eridu, endowed with wisdom, changed the speech in their mouths, put contention into it, into the speech of man that had been won." That is Kramer's translation.
"That's a story," Hero says. "I thought a Namshub was an incantation."
"The Namshub of Enki is both a story and an incantation," the librarian says. "A self-fulfilling fiction. Lagos believed that in its original form, which this translation only hints at, it actually did what it describes."
"You mean, change the speech in men's mouths?"
"Yes," the librarian says.
"This is a Babel story, isn't it?" Hero says. "Everyone was speaking the same language, and then Enki changed their speech so that they could no longer understand each other. This must be the basis for the Tower of Babel stuff in the Bible."
"This room contains a number of cards tracing that connection," the librarian says.
"You mentioned before that, at one point, everyone spoke Sumerian. Then nobody did. It just vanished like the dinosaurs. And there's no genocide to explain how that happened, which is consistent with the Tower of Babel story and the Namshub of Enki. Did Lagos think that Babel really happened?"
"He was sure of it. He was quite concerned about the vast number of human languages. He felt there were simply too many of them."
"How many?"
"Tens of thousands. In many parts of the world, you will find people of the same ethnic group living a few miles apart in similar valleys under similar conditions, speaking languages that have absolutely nothing in common with each other. This sort of thing is not an oddity. It is ubiquitous. Many